Session number 7266, Reel 4.
General Lloyd, Reel 4. Having visited the Maginot Line, I think you then went to look at the area in which you'd have to prepare your extension to that line. What sort of impression did you get of the terrain and the field works and the general deployment of the BEF?
Of course, the terrain for the extension of the Maginot Line was very much flatter than my recollection of the Maginot Line itself, and also the territory in front of it, which was at that time a no-man's land. And I think I told you that when we were in the Maginot Line, we had an opportunity of patrolling forward into this margin, into this territory, and having a general idea of the very unreal conditions, of course, that persisted at that time. By that I mean that you could, through field glasses, you could clearly see the German lines opposite, but there was no sort of activity whatsoever taking place at that particular time.
No shooting going
on?
No
shooting, no. In fact, I believe, I'm not absolutely certain about this, but I believe there was an embargo on the French against any form of active contact with the enemy. And all the patrols, certainly the British patrols that went out from the one infantry division that was kept on the Maginot Line with the French, operated under that embargo. But to come back to the extension of the Maginot Line, it was typically Pas-de-Calais territory. That is to say, basically flat with the occasional undulating landscape, rather like, which would be Suffolk, I suppose, rather like Suffolk. And also the fact that the sapper plan for the extension was based on a zigzag line of pillboxes. And owing to the extreme 1939-40 winter, they'd had to use mechanical picks for doing the elementary task of digging holes for the location of concrete emplacements.
Did you inspect many of the pillboxes?
Yes, some of them, one or two, I should think, perhaps on the half a dozen in total. Of course, by comparison with the Maginot Line type of emplacement, there was simply no comparison. But on the other hand, as I know from subsequent entrenchments in other theatres of war, I would have said that the tactical sighting of the defences was far superior to the basic ideas on which the Maginot Line was based. By that I mean defence in depth and proper provision for forward defended localities and that sort of thing. All of which, of course, would have to be very much conditioned by the type of armament that was going to be used. With regard to that, of course, I'm using the phrase "of course" a great deal, I'm afraid, for which I apologise. By that I mean that everything that I say must, of course, be partly discounted by my reading and discussion with people after the event. But that of course, you will know, is something that one always has to take into account when reading history.
Now you say that there was provision for defence in depth. How many lines of pillboxes were there, roughly?
I can't be absolutely certain about that, but I have in mind that there were four main zones extending over a belt of about, I should think, must have been 10 miles depth. Roughly northeast, positioned northeast to southwest, along the approximate line parallel to the Franco-Belgian border, with the centre line extending from, what would it be, the northwestern flank of the Maginot Line to just about where the expeditionary force was re-embarked at Dunkirk.
In one of these zones, what sort of pattern were the pillboxes deployed into?
Well, as far as I can tell, roughly zigzag. I remember at one time seeing a diagram prepared by, who would it be now, the Chief Engineer? Major General, I ought to know his name. I'll give it to you in a moment when my memory clicks. I'm just about certain that it was that the area covered by the extension was about 10 miles in depth and, of course, extended from the northwestern flank of the Maginot Line to the sea, the Channel coast at Dunkirk.
How far apart would the pillboxes be on average?
Well, it varied with the terrain. I remember that. Average distance, I would have thought, was about 500 yards. That is to say, reasonable range for a .303 rifle bullet. And after all, the 303 round was the basic round, was it not, used in the British Army, and probably the French Army as well, for that matter.
You mentioned that the whole scheme would be conditioned by the armaments that it was expected would be available. What sort of armaments did you have in mind?
Well, I do remember that in addition to the pillboxes, there were concrete battery positions for field artillery. That is to say, that would have been based on the 25-pounder.
These would have been to the rear of the...
To the rear of the emplacement, yes. And then further back still, there was provision for the medium artillery emplacements. That is, that would be the, let me see, the 60-pounder and the 6-inch Howe. But I don't think there was any provision for anything further than that. There were no... the one great omission that I remember discussing at the time was the very few tank traps that were embodied in the scheme. And, of course, don't forget, at that time, we had been conditioned to expect tank traps. You know, they literally were scattered in front of the Maginot Line, for example, but there were very, very few of them in front of the extension that we had planned. Mind you, you have to take all this with a pinch of salt, because this may well have been conditioned by the appalling winter that had just gone before. And it may well have been, for example, that had the winter been better, that the opportunity would have been taken to build tank traps, whereas it was so bad that, in all probability, the scheme had to be abandoned.
What form did the tank traps take?
You mean those that existed?
Those that were there, yes.
Well, they were the... I think they were called the hedgehog type. That is to say, roughly lozenge-shaped masses of concrete.
Rather than ditches?
Rather than ditches. Oh, yes. No ditches that I can remember. Still, of course, that might well have been... the lack of ditches might have been accounted for by the fact that, of course, the British Expeditionary Force, as opposed to, say, the French or Belgian equivalent, was based on a highly mobile force with mobile tactics. Whereas, as we've already mentioned, the French and the French we've certainly mentioned, they were based on static warfare, and the Belgians, as I discovered afterwards, of course, they also were based on static warfare.
What about anti-tank guns?
Well, it's a little difficult to cast my mind back to that because my knowledge of anti-tank guns is conditioned by what happened after 1940. But the Expeditionary Force proper was equipped with 2-pounders, and of course the 25-pounder, which had an anti-tank role in the point blank position. I can't remember any other anti-tank guns being in the Expeditionary Force.
Was there provision for anti-tank gun positions in the
only the 25-pounder position.
So you couldn't have used one from one of the pillboxes?
No, only a 2-pounder.
What about...
Or the boys' anti-tank rifle.
The Boy Scouts anti-tank rifle.
The Boy Scout, that's right, yeah.
What about the provision for the use of machine guns, of Vickers guns? Could they have been used from the pillboxes?
Oh, they were... Yes, there was provision for those in the pillboxes. Oh, yes.
When you were inspecting this line, was it manned or was it just there waiting to be...
No, it wasn't manned, no. I think I'm right in saying that the plan for occupation was to be a defensive plan. That is to say, if the Germans broke through. But, of course, what in fact happened was that the Expeditionary Force advanced... in 1940, well before the... well in front of the extension to the Maginot Line, and in fact, of course, the extension was never occupied. Not to my knowledge, anyhow.
Were the concrete pillboxes connected by lines of trenches?
Communicated trenches? No. No. Definitely not.
Presumably, these would have been... Doug, if your division had a chance to do its work?
Well, presumably, the whole thing would have been... the whole thing would have been developed and extended if we'd ever had the opportunity. But I really can't say anything with certainty about that. I was, after all, not very senior at the time, and I only had an opportunity of seeing, you know, what... when the opportunity permitted.
What about wire? Was there a lot of wire?
Oh, yes. Of course, Dannet wire was existed in very large quantity. But the barbed wire was not, in fact, laid. It was simply... there were simply huge dumps of it.
Do you know anything about how it was planned to lay it? What sort of use they would have made of it?
No, I don't. Anything I could say on that would be pure surmise, I'm afraid. I know nothing about that at all.
And mines, what about that? Was there any provision for the use of mines.
Do you know, I don't think there was ever any mention of mines in connection with the extension to the Maginot Line. The Maginot Line itself, of course, had extensive minefields in front of it. But I have no knowledge whatsoever of them being deployed in our front, in the front of our position on the extension. None whatever. I don't believe, in fact, we had them. Digressing for a moment, do you know anything about that, Saul?
Perhaps we'd better move on to the shooting war. What were you doing on the 10th of May when you first heard that the German offensive had begun?
The one vivid memory I have is that I personally was out of my headquarters when the shooting started, and I heard of the outbreak of hostilities, if I could call it that, from a unit which I was visiting. And, of course, I hurried back to our headquarters and brought myself up to date with what was happening. From then on, there was a period of, I suppose, amounting to about 24 hours of uncertainty and so on. And I hasten to say that at no time from then until we eventually found ourselves back in England was the situation ever at all crystal clear. It was, in fact, a period of very, very great confusion and uncertainty. More so than I was later to expect, for example, with the information that we were given at Headquarters 21 Army Group, which was, I always thought, quite remarkably accurate and up-to-date.
Do you think that might be because Montgomery had learned a lesson in France, that it was, in Belgium, that it was a good thing to keep the troops up to date and well informed?
Well, it may have been that, but I think that we have to take all sorts of things into account. One thing, for example, is that communications in France in 1940. Wherever I happened to go, was mainly by telephone, whereas, of course, to skip a few years and come to 21 Army Group, of course, the communications were mainly by wireless. It is true that we had wireless sets in France in 1940, but I still think that our communication mainly relied upon line communication, telephone line communication. And the proof of that, I think, is that when the Germans employed their dive bombers in front of their advance and behind the Belgian lines, the French lines and our lines, of course, the civilian cables were brought down, and more often than not, that brought about a complete cessation of communications in our own headquarters. And communication was only established after a while by use of our own signal wires, broadcast signals. I have one memory of active contact with a communication unit, because I think I told you earlier on that one of my very vivid memories of France in 1940 was the way in which the Belgian and French roads were packed from side to side by refugees And I remember at one point on the coast road leading from Abbeville southwest, coming across a GHQ wireless vehicle, a great big 10-ton lorry, from headquarters BEF at Arras, which had escaped somehow or other, and was caught up in a huge crowd of refugees. And as a matter of fact, there was a corporal driving it who'd completely lost his head. I got out of the staff car in which I was by the side of the road and ordered him to divert his vehicle with the idea of taking it into our own charge, and he was in a blind state of panic, and my driver had to hit him to bring him to his senses. Eventually, that great big wireless vehicle came everywhere with us from that point onwards.
Was it useful as a means of communication?
Yes, it was, as a matter of fact. We got in touch with, not with any of our own people, but we were able to get in touch with Britain.
Did you manage to keep in touch with the larger picture by listening to the BBC at all when you were in France?
No, I don't think... I must think about that. No, I don't think we... I can't remember ever listening to the BBC, but we did listen constantly to the French radio. In fact, to skip on a bit, I can vividly remember being with a number of friends of mine, quite by chance, in a French estaminet when France fell. The memory is remarkably vivid because the French were standing at attention and singing the Marseillaise, and I'm afraid we were very unhelpful. And my chaps were singing Roll Out the Barrel. Anyway, to answer your question, we listened to the French radio, but I can't remember ever listening to the BBC.
Did you ever get newspapers from England?
No.
So it was just the French radio that was your source of
French radio and French newspapers.
Were they at all accurate in their reports?
No. I remember the French radio gave us the impression that there was a great mobile reserve held behind the left flank of the Maginot Line, and the impression vividly implanted on us was that the great expectation that from day to day somehow or other, the French would counterattack and cut off the German advancing forces and block them, cut them off, you know, from their own rear. And it was a sublime sense of self-confidence at that time that this would happen, and that they would be swept into the bag.
It must have come as a nasty shock to many of the listeners when the fall of France occurred.
Oh, the effect on the French was absolutely devastating. There's no question about that. They were absolutely shattered. If ever there was a broken country, it was the French. Everywhere one went on that day and for days following, there were tears pouring down the faces of the French, you know. They were so desperately upset. But on the other hand, never at any time did it occur to anybody that I knew in the British Army that we were ever going to lose the war. It really was the most extraordinary thing, because all the evidence, of course, was to the contrary. But nevertheless, there was this ebullient sense of esprit de corps, you know. No account were we going to lose the war.
Now, you say that after the news that the German offensive had started, there was a day or so of confusion. What orders did the 12th Division get?
I think our initial orders must have been... I never actually saw them, of course, but our initial orders must have been to take up a lines of communication role. But as the German advance succeeded and the situation became more and more dicey, the 12th Division became regarded as having a reinforcing role. At no point, of course, could be regarded as a satisfactory fighting force. But nevertheless, just to give you one example of the sort of thing that happened, it must have been that orders had gone out from the expeditionary, the headquarters BEF, to reinforce the expeditionary force by way of supplies, food, guns, weapons generally, and ammunition. And the reason why I'm so certain about this is because I suppose we were approximately, what would it be, about halfway from the base depots to the front line of the expeditionary force. And right in the middle of our area, at one point, there were a few field guns, 25-pounders, and a few medium guns, so much so that in the interim, these guns were swept up and formed into a scratch battery of artillery, which was in fact given to me to command. I was the only artillery officer at the headquarters. And for about a week, I had a scratch battery consisting of about four 25-pounders and two 60-pounders, with ammunition brought up by the Army Service Corps from the base depots, and the men were got from a reinforcement unit.
Were they all gunners?
All gunners, oh yes, all gunners. They were got out of...